From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. 49 years ago this month, New York City police raided an underground gay club at Stonewall Inn in Manhattan's Greenwich Village.
In the civil rights movement, we ran from the police. That night, the police ran from us.
There was no going back. We had discovered a power that we weren't even aware that we had.
It was a turning point in what was then called the gay rights movement. Tonight, Atlanta Pride joins with the LGBT Institute at the National Center for Civil and Human Rights and the Fox Theater to commemorate Stonewall and how far the movement has come. Emmy Award-winning actor and comedian Wanda Sykes headlines at the Fox with Tig Notaro. Also on the ticket, a drag show and a concert with Blondie. I spoke with Wanda Sykes from L.A. and asked why Atlanta has become such a nexus for Pride.
I think with the diversity and everything, it's just a place where, you know, people feel comfortable. And of course, you know, Atlanta knows how to party, too. So that's great.
Doesn't hurt. I think for a long time, people, you know, living in other parts of the South probably didn't have a place to gather.
Exactly. Yeah. You go a little further south and not a lot of pride going on down there. So Atlanta, you know, you still have this your southern roots, and but still feel like it's a place where you can have your community and feel safe.
Well, Wanda, let's get to a little history here. The Stonewall riots, these broke out in 1969. This was following a police raid at the Stonewall Inn, which is a gay bar in Manhattan. What made you want to do a comedy show for the occasion?
Well, you know, when Pride Month rolls around, we get busy, and this comedy just seems to be a good way to celebrate because everybody likes to laugh, and to be able to, it's an easy way to talk about, you know, start a dialogue about, you know, important issues, but in a bit of a funny way.
Here's Martin Duberman. He's an author. He wrote a book called Stonewall. This is from a documentary called Stonewall Uprising.
It's almost impossible for young gay people today to understand what it was like back then. The reason why so many gay men went to Stonewall was that it was pretty much the only dancing bar in town. But as soon as the lights went on, that was the signal. Stop at once. Because what would happen would be unannounced police raids.
Wanda, did you know anything about Stonewall when you were growing up?
No, not when I was growing up, no. I didn't know anything about it.
So this was something that really was a landmark event in the gay rights movement. When did you find out about it?
Wow, I guess probably in the, I want to say in the 90s, probably. Probably late 90s, because that's when I was living in New York and living in Manhattan. And I was working on the Chris Rock show. So, you know, I've been to that bar. So that's, you know, I guess that's when I've learned about it. And also, you know, was going through drag shows and then also going out to Fire Island. We have Uncle Johnny, who's a bartender at Cherry's, and he was actually there during the riot. So, learned a lot from him, just like, firsthand how it happened and all. So growing up we didn't know anything about it.
Right. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Then I moved to but mainly in the Maryland, DC area where I went to school.
Here's a little bit more about that documentary recounting the events from the riots with police.
The police would often just barrel through, throw customers, throw them, push them against the side of the wall, march back and forth through the bar, spreading terror. That kind of message, you internalize.
Hearing that clip now, I mean, what do you think? Being aware of well-publicized events and occasions of police brutality, especially in the African-American community, is there a correlation between those issues?
Definitely. I mean, it's still happening. It's except within the African American community, we see it, especially with the now everyone has cell phones. But you know, nothing has changed. It's been going on since forever. So I guess at that time with Stonewall, it just happened to be white gay men who were some in drag who were harassed that day, and of course the community is still being harassed, but African Americans, this is nothing new for us.
Mm. And almost 40 years later in 2016, there was the worst mass shooting in American history. This was at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando back in 2016. What do you think, about these two incidents and attacks on the LGBT community?
It's tragic. It just proves that, that hate is still, very at the forefront as far as when it comes to targeting, our communities. And we need, tougher laws, and especially, there's over 30-something states where you can be fired just for being, gay or lesbian, so transgender. So, we need tougher laws and, hate crimes. We just more needs to be done.
You are a regular on the show Curb Your Enthusiasm and also on Black-ish. Now, this is now in its fourth season. I want to play a little clip. This is from season one. There's a conversation in the Johnson household. That's kind of the family that this is centered on, about a character named Rhonda. This is played by Raven Simone, who is a lesbian. Here, Dre's wife is trying to convince him to tell his mother the truth about her. Let's hear the clip.
Dre, what's the worst thing that could happen if you actually said the words, Rhonda is gay?
What's the best thing that could happen?
Auntie Rhonda is gay?
Wanda, how important is it to you for people to hear these kind of conversations on TV and in the media?
I love that. I mean, the more you talk about it, the more visible we are, and and also there's so many people out there who are still hiding and they don't feel comfortable. And I think the more you see us. And that we're, shown as just people trying to live our lives, and that it makes it easier for the people to, to be comfortable in their own skin and to live their true self. So, I encourage it.
I read that you didn't come out to your parents until you were in your 40s. What was holding you back?
I just wasn't ready. I mean, and then when I did come out, it was very hard for my family. But it just takes time. And if they see that you're comfortable with yourself and that's just who you are, then they have no choice but to accept you if they still want you in their lives. And that's where we are, and we're in a great place.
Well, now you are married. You have kids. Do you have two kids? Have I got that right? Twins?
Mm-hmm. Twins. Yep. A boy and a girl.
Did you ever think growing up that you would become a parent?
I always saw myself with kids, but I was by myself. For some reason I thought, I'll probably get married and have some kids, and then he'll die or I don't know. I always saw myself like maybe with kids, but I never saw a guy or a husband with me. And then I got to a point where I was like, oh God, no, I don't want kids at all. And when I met my wife, when I met her, I was in the mindset of like, no kids. But after falling in love with her, and this was like, of course, why wouldn't I want to start a family with this person?
Well, you are also a voice actor. I know you were in Ice Age. You played, or voiced, rather, Sid's grandmother. And Chloe in Rio, do you at least get some street cred with your kids for, you know, being in really super popular movies?
It took them a while to catch on that it was me. At first, they wouldn't believe me.
Really?
Yeah, they did, yeah. So, but now they're into it. And now they're all about Vampirina because that's the new show I'm doing now. It's the same creator who did Doc McStuffins, Chris New. So I'm doing, I played Gregoria, the gargoyle.
Really? Do you have your Gregoria voice or can you only pull it out like, you know, on contract or something?
It's basically my voice. When they book me, I think I'm supposed to show up with full voice, and they're like, no, just you, yeah, that's fine.
So what can we expect from your upcoming comedy show here in Atlanta?
Well, it's a brand new hour that I'm working on, and I'm really happy with where it is right now. Like, I was just in Palm Beach over the weekend and had great shows, so. You know, I'm talking about a lot of stuff. You know, race is, as we see, we have a lot of problems with it. So I'm talking about that. Of course, I talk about my family, and of course, talking about this administration. So, we're covering a lot, but there's a lot of big laughs,
It must be a challenge to turn some of those things that are, you know, heavy subjects into laughs. Where do you go to do that? How do you do that?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is just like common sense. If you're speaking the truth, but you can do it with a funny slant, a funny take on it, then people enjoy that. You know, it just got to make sure it's funny. Like, I'm not. You know, on a soapbox and just giving a speech. There's a lot of jokes. So, but that's the thing. You just gotta, as long as you keep it funny, people are gonna enjoy it. Unless you're like a hardcore Trump supporter, then you'll probably, you know, walk out, which gives me great delight too, because I'm keeping your money. Yeah, no refund.
What do you think, Wanda? Looking forward. And looking back, you know, 29 years after Stonewall, some of the biggest challenges for the LGBT community.
Like I said, we need protection there. You know, you can't be fired just for being LGBT. You just we need that. I think that's the big one.
Award-winning comedian and actor Wanda Sykes. You can catch her comedy show at the Fox Theater tonight at 8 with Tig Notaro, who we'll be speaking to up next. Go to gpbnews.org for more. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, I spoke with Wanda Sykes, who is headlining a 49th anniversary commemoration of the Stonewall riots tonight with another comedian, Tig Notaro. She broke through the stand-up comedy circuit in 2012, ironically, by talking on stage about the breast cancer diagnosis she had just received.
I have cancer. How are you? Hi, how are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you? It's a good time. Diagnosed with cancer. Feels good. Just diagnosed with cancer. God.
Tig Notaro initially thought of backing out of the gig, but decided to press ahead. I asked her about that when I interviewed her for NHPR in 2015. At that point, she had been cancer-free for the last two checkups. I also asked her about growing up in the South.
I was born in Jackson, Mississippi, and then we moved down to the Gulf Coast to Pas Christian, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Spring, Texas, which is a smaller town outside of Houston.
Yeah, you dropped out of high school. Did you know then you wanted to be a comedian?
No, I pretty much just knew I did not want to be in school. I failed three grades and dropped out. And I mean, I was definitely the mischievous class clown in school, but I didn't really know. I loved stand-up as a kid, and I followed it and listened to records and stuff, but I just I didn't know for sure, I think, until I was in my early 20s.
Well, I guess you were kind of doing your bit or establishing your bona fides, because a lot of comedians began as miscreants, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I think so. I always, whenever I'm hanging out with my friends in Los Angeles, I always refer to everyone as the land of misfit toys from, you know, those claymation shows.
Right. From the Santa Claus is coming.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
Right. So what's the appeal for you as a performer playing to these little stages? I mean, I thought that once you get big, you don't perform for nine people anymore.
Well, I appreciate that you think I'm big. I don't know. I think there's comedy is always great in awkward and unsafe environments. And I think that that's kind of a way that you can get back to that, because walking into a comedy club when you're a known comedian or you have a very worked out show, it is a pretty safe ride. But when you are working out new material or you have no material, which is what happened to me on that tour, I had no new material. I relied on a few old jokes in that taping, but in general, I was trying to get my feet wet again after having old material and then announcing that I had cancer in this show a couple of years ago. And then it kind of cleaned my slate with material where when I got back out, I was like, God, I really don't have anything. And so it puts you into that unsafe, exciting environment, being in someone's living room.
That it sounds terrifying to me.
It is. Trust me.
And
but
awkward.
It's also exhilarating.
Yeah, is it? So
uh-huh.
Do you feel like you've come away from that experience with what?
I can't wait to do it again.
Really?
Yeah. I hope it turns into a TV show down the road.
But you used to be known anyway as a deadpan comic, not offering a lot of clues about who you are. And then this, after initially announcing that you had cancer at that show at Largo.
Oh, my God. It's weird because with humor, the equation is tragedy plus time equals comedy. I am just at tragedy right now. That's just where I am in the equation. Oh, it's fine. Here's what happened. It's very personal. Found a lump. Guys, relax. Everything's fine. I have cancer.
I'm thinking of those hours beforehand. I mean, did you decide you were going to do this? Did you rehearse it? What happened?
Well, I had several days. I was diagnosed on July 25th, and the show was August 3rd. And so I spent those days just reflecting on how I felt. And I had originally wanted to cancel the show, but the owner of the club suggested I just keep the show and see how I felt right up to the last second. And if I didn't want to do it, I could cancel. So I kept it on the books, and then I just kept writing and seeing how I felt. And I knew that I couldn't have, because aside from cancer, I'd also, my mother died unexpectedly after an accident, and I was in the middle of a breakup, and I had another illness where I couldn't eat food. I was really at rock bottom, and so I could not bring myself to get on stage with a cancer diagnosis and, you know, a skeletal frame of a body and just be like, oh my gosh, so I was traveling the other day, you know, and just make lighthearted jokes. I felt like I had something massive staring me in the face and I needed to acknowledge it and hopefully make light of it. And so, and yeah, it wasn't my typical style, but before I walked on stage, I was so nervous because I knew I was about to do something I had never done. Mm. And that I had no clue how it was going to go. And, yeah, so the safety was definitely gone there.
People talk about you on stage. I'm wondering what you saw in the audience as you were looking out.
I mean, it was such a mix of confused people waiting for the punchline and just shock and awkward laughter, and then the more I kept talking about things, the more it became clear that it wasn't a joke. It was just really a setup of, you know, truth so that I could explore all the different aspects of what I was going through and make light of it. And once people started to realize it was true, I also saw people crying in the audience. And it was really a mixed bag to look out into. And it was also a reality check, letting me know that this was really happening. It was kind of hard to comprehend everything. Very surreal moments that I would go in and out of.
And now when you hear those clips of you doing that, I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you feel like...
Oh. I don't listen to those clips. I mean, honestly, if somebody's playing it in an interview or... And it's not just from that show that it's hard to listen to. It's hard to listen to anything of myself. I really can't think of anything worse than hearing myself. And it's not like, oh, that this is such a hard time and painful time. It's just, oh, my gosh, I can't hear myself. I used to listen to myself when I was first starting out as a stand-up, and I would record all my shows. And even now when I'm working out new material, I'll sometimes record the audio. But I always think it's a funny sight if somebody walked in and heard me listening to my audio, because I'm telling jokes. You hear the audience laughing, and my face is very stoic and serious listening. My face does not look like I understand comedy at all when I'm listening very intently.
Do people now who have cancer seek you out? I mean, do they think you're kind of the cancer comic, the one who's been through it?
I don't know what people think, but I certainly get quite the mix of people at my shows, from podcast fans that listen to my podcast, comedy nerds and cancer survivors, and just every person across the board. And it's really an interesting mix of people. People that have just had a bad day and listened to my show from 2012, had a bad day at the office, and they're like, wow, that really put things into perspective for me. And so I don't know what brings people to me, but I know it seems to be, you know, from casting a wide net through all the different avenues I've taken along the way.
That was comedian Tig Notaro. She and Wanda Sykes headline Atlanta Pride Stonewall Celebrations tonight at the Fox Theater in Atlanta. There are a number of other events, including Blondie on Friday night. For details, go to gpbnews.org. The Stonewall riots were a pivotal moment in what was then called gay rights. I want to shift our attention to another historic event for the LGBT community in Atlanta. In 1997, Eric Rudolph, the man behind the bombing at the Summer Olympic Games in Atlanta, left a pair of bombs at a gay bar. It was called the Other Side Lounge. No one died in the bombing, but several people were injured. Owners Dana Ford and Beverly McMahon recall the attack and how it changed their lives.
That was Friday night at 10:30. It was one of the highlights of the club. We had over a couple hundred people, Dana.
Yeah, I think 100, 150 to 200 people were there because we did a lot of tourist business. During that time, we got a call from our manager that there was an explosion on the patio. And he said, at the time, you know, you speculate, you know, transformer or something of that nature, and that's what he was speculating. I myself knew there was nothing out there that would be that powerful to blow up.
Once again, a bomb in the night. It happened outside a lesbian club called The Other Side.
When I arrived and started coming into the driveway, the valet was still hanging outside. I gave my key to them and went inside to make an assessment. There was somebody frantically being treated on the floor. Obviously, it looked to me like they were bleeding out. There was a woman on the phone that had blood drenched on one half of her body. So, you know, and all this is processing very fast. It's not as long as I'm speaking. I'm just making those assessments. And I walked back to the cop, who was still there, and young guy. And I said, so what do you think? And he goes, I guess it must have been a bomb, just like that. I said, well, I think you're probably right. So I said, who's the officer on duty or in charge of the scene? And he gave me a name, and I went out front, and she was actually a sergeant. And she turned to me and said, we think we found another device. And I said, okay, what do we need to do? And she said, well, we need to get the people out of there, and we can't let them know that we found something. We have to keep them calm. Didn't go off when it was supposed to, which, you know, is probably why I'm here and those people who are exiting are here, because it was right about that time. And law enforcement actually had trouble getting it to fire. You know, they shook it, they hit it with water cannon, they threw a live round at it, and it really didn't even go off until they were actually moving it.
A police robot shot it with a stream of water about 2 this morning, and it exploded.
The ATF agent asked who owned the Lincoln that was in the driveway, and we said we did. She goes, well, you used to own it, and it's totaled now, but just know that it saved the lives of about 3 officers. Because it absorbed a lot of the blast.
As in the double bombing last month, there was no warning. But Atlanta Police Chief Beverly Harvard says someone did call after the explosion.
I'm not going to go into any details about it.
Atlanta Mayor Bill Campbell.
We clearly believe that we are dealing with a deranged killer, but one who is very clever as well.
No one knew who set those bombs off. You know, so the community was really afraid to come back in. I tried everything to recapture and make it happen, but, you know, I'm sure you know that we didn't get financially our insurance money, things that we should have.
Back then, they didn't have that kind of coverage necessarily for terrorist acts. It was acts of God and assaults. That's what they were worried about in the bar business. And Bev and I, we were at a loss for how do you market against fear.
We lost about $5 million through all of this.
5.8.
So that's very hard to swallow.
I would like to introduce the director of the ATF, Director McGaugh.
Thank you, sir. Most people came to the lounge in Atlanta to meet with friends and enjoy relaxation. At least one came with hatred, with intent to injure.
Because it went on 5 years to find Eric Rudolph, that's really what took us all the way down.
Today's capture of Eric Robert Rudolph in North Carolina ends a 5-year manhunt.
We saw him in person at the court. We all had a chance to speak with him. He just stares at you with just a hollow look. That's one of my dreams. I would love to go to the prison and ask him why. Why did he do that? He didn't answer that question to me in court. I told him I would pray for him, which I do. Try to keep my anger and keep myself focused on, I can't get the money back. I can't get a lot of things back, but I am so blessed to have my family and my friends, my church. Dana and I are very, very lucky, even though, you know, I have to work the rest of my life. I'm not sure I like that, but, you know, maybe it's keeping me younger. Who knows?
Dana Ford and Beverly McMahon owned the Other Side Lounge, a gay bar in Atlanta that was bombed in 1997 by Eric Rudolph. The story was produced by On Second Thoughts' Sean Powers. Just ahead, Atlanta's city government wins top place, a questionable achievement, given that it is for a lack of transparency. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow, we're going to focus on the long and complicated relationship between immigration and detention in America. What do you think of the administration's policy to separate families crossing illegally into the U.S.? You can give us a call at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. You can also let us know on Facebook or Twitter at OST Talk what you're thinking, and we may feature your comments on the show. The city of Atlanta has received many honors. In 1996, we hosted the Olympics. Next year, it's the Super Bowl. And this week, the city received the Golden Padlock Award. Huh? Each year, a conference of investigative reporters and editors gives the dubious distinction to the most secretive agency or person in government. Robert Cribb is chair of the Golden Padlock Committee, and he's joining us by Skype from Toronto to talk about how Atlanta beat out the competition. Rob, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, because we've also got Scott Truby in the studio with us. He's a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Scott, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
So, Robert, this is Atlanta's first Golden Padlock, but you have been giving out the award for a couple of years now. Let's listen to you introducing it in 2015.
So for those of you who don't know what this award is, it's a sort of a moment of collective journalistic catharsis where we breathe deeply and we appreciate and acknowledge those who make our professional lives challenging. Because out of challenge comes great journalism, as we all know, and so we hand this award out every year with both a sense of deep outrage and also that sweet, subtle taste of forced accountability.
Last year, Scott Pruitt, then Oklahoma Attorney General, head of the Oklahoma Attorney General's Office, and now head of the EPA, won. The year before that, it was the Department of Veterans Affairs. So why did Atlanta win/not win this honor this year?
Atlanta has been a fierce competitor for this award now for the last 2 years, actually. It was nominated last year. It was one of the finalists. And this year, it also made the finalist list, making it the first agency since the birth of this award in 2013 to ever be nominated twice. And this year, of course, it was the victor for it's really a series of things that was brought to our attention by reporters at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Channel 2 News, who have been doing some remarkable work, some transparency work in Atlanta, digging up public records, or at least seeking public records of vital public importance, and hitting fierce resistance from City Hall. And what was striking about this year's nomination, which came from the journalists there, was this remarkable moment where we were able to see text message exchanges obtained through Freedom of Information requests, in which senior city staff were advising staff on how to respond to these requests, which would release public records that could be embarrassing, obviously, to the administration. And the candor with which they advised the city officials to withhold, to delay, to make the process as painful as possible was really quite remarkable.
Well, let's hear about Scott on that. Scott, the city staff actually directed to block records requests. So what were reporters requesting and what
were the city staff told to do with the request?
Well, there are different prongs to this, but I'll start in March. So in March, we found out that there were these text messages between former Mayor Reed's press secretary, Jenna Garland, and a staffer at the Watershed Department. Channel 2 had asked for water billing records from Watershed about addresses that belonged to city officials. And later we found out that many city officials weren't paying their water bills. Ms. Garland wrote to the staffer telling her to drag this out and to make compliance with or to make the product of the open records request as confusing as possible.
Hmm.
Later, we discovered that the city's law department had provided the AJC with what it called legal invoices that were actually not legitimate legal invoices. They were not the actual legal invoices that we had requested, and they had passed it off as legitimate documents.
In fact, they created fake invoices, as far as you can tell.
They did.
That's a lot of effort on
it
their
is.
Part. Now, Mayor Kasim Reed's administration decided to withhold a grand jury subpoena last year. Now, how did the administration explain that decision, and what was it trying to hide?
On the subpoena, you mean?
Yes.
So to give a little background, so last year the federal government made public a federal corruption investigation. They charged two contractors with a pay-to-play scheme for snow removal contracts and for sidewalk contracts. After the investigation became public, the AJC, Channel 2, and others made requests of the city for a number of public records, including any subpoenas the city had received. After mounting public pressure, then Mayor Kasim Reed had a press conference in which he unveiled about 1.4 million pages of paper documents. Listeners may remember that scene from February of last year. What we learned only a few weeks ago was that when the city released those documents, they included two subpoenas to the city, one that included the two contractors who pleaded guilty, and another that included records for a former city official who was a campaign aide to Mayor Reed. What they did not release at the time was a subpoena related to Mayor Reed's actions in firing the former airport general manager, Miguel Southwell, in 2016. And it also related to contracts at the airport and the Watershed Department. Our legal experts said that that subpoena should have been handed over like the others. And in the case of all other subpoenas that we're aware of, the city has promptly handed them over when we've requested them. But not that one. And we don't know why. We know that the city, that Mayor Reed, former Mayor Reed, when contacted about it, and former city attorney Kathy Hampton, both said that they were sensitive related to the investigation and that they couldn't be released until Kathy Hampton said they couldn't be released until all the documents had been provided to the feds that were responsive to that subpoena. However, that was not the standard for any of the other subpoenas. In fact, the city is still responding with records to the eight known subpoenas that we have that we are aware of thus far.
So text directing people to drag this out, fake documents, holding back documents. Is this just bad conduct or is this breaking the law?
Well, that I can't say, but the Georgia Bureau of Investigation is trying to find that out. After our initial reporting of the first batch of text messages and the legal invoices situation, the Attorney General ordered a criminal investigation by the GBI into the conduct of open records at City Hall. That investigation is ongoing. As part of that investigation, they have actually interviewed reporters at Channel 2 and at the AJC, but not myself. They interviewed two other reporters at the paper. They have interviewed a number of people at City Hall. I believe they have requested records. They certainly have requested documentation from the AJC and Channel 2 in terms of our interactions with City Hall.
That's Scott Truby. He's a reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he's talking about some of the obfuscating tactics of the City Hall administration, which are one of the things that helped contribute to Atlanta, the city of Atlanta, winning the Golden Padlock Award for a lack of transparency. Scott, what do Georgia open records laws actually require?
So when you file an open records request, and keep in mind, these open records requests, this is not just for the media. The public relies upon open records law to obtain vital documents for anything imaginable that the state or local governments have. When you file an open records request, the state or the city or the county that you live in, or doesn't even have to be the one you live in, but the state, the government, has to provide the record within 3 days or provide you with an estimated time of how long it will take to fulfill the request within 3 business days. Records that are, you know, easily attainable should be provided immediately. And what we found is that the city was not doing that.
Did the city get any reason for not being open about these requests?
They have said that they were following the law, but their interpretation of the law is not consistent with our newspaper and Channel 2's attorneys, and nor is it consistent with constitutional law experts that we have talked to outside of the situation. There is a criminal statute in Georgia's open records law, and it says that if you frustrate or attempt to frustrate a request for an open records, that can be punishable as a misdemeanor.
So, Robert, in your speech at the IRE Awards, you refer to the forced accountability for open records laws. Why is it important to shine light on governments that are not transparent with the public?
Well, I think it's very important. It's a matter of vital public interest. These are not questions that are being asked randomly for private interests. Journalists seek these records out in the name of the public for reasons that affect all of our lives. These are the records that tell us about potential health risks, about how public money is being spent, about corruption. So when they are being denied on behalf of the public, it's undermining the democratic free flow of information, the marketplace of ideas, and the vital information flow that allows us to decide how we feel about how governments are acting in our name. And it's far too often an issue that never makes the public agenda. This is not a discussion that we typically have on radio shows about the, about access to information or freedom of information laws. It very much is seen, I think, to be inside baseball. It's a journalist thing, but that's actually not true. It just isn't true that these questions being asked every day of governments are of vital public importance. And the award, the conception of the award when I initially pitched it to the investigative reporters and editors was a method of trying to get this discussion more broadly held outside journalism circles into the public realm.
And since you've been giving them away in 2013, I believe, any of those awards led to charges being filed?
No, I would say one of the things we do at the awards ceremony when we hand this out is we always invite the winner to attend and receive the award.
Does anyone show up?
No one has ever shown up. So to the best of our knowledge, on the record, no one even has acknowledged their victories or their nominations in this. But we're given to believe, talking to reporters who have nominated agencies that have won or been recognized, that it does have quiet internal impact, that there has been evidence of a focusing of the mind around these issues within these agencies that have been honored in this way, and a greater sensibility and sensitivity to these issues. So that
let me just stop you there, because I want to make sure that we get to hear the subsequent administration. Keisha Lance Bottoms, new mayor, elected in November. This is a speech that she gave on her, or piece of a speech that she gave on her 100th day in office.
In 2013, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group issued a report on transparency in city spending. Atlanta's grade was an F. That is unacceptable. Public information belongs to the public, and that includes how we spend our money.
Well, what do you think, Scott? Do you have a lot of faith, or have you seen changes in the way that the Keisha Lance Bottoms administration is handling these requests?
So Mayor Bottoms did campaign, and actually, since she took office, has touted a commitment to transparency. Since she came into office, she announced a program called Atlanta's Open Checkbook, which would allow the public to look at the city's finances. She since has proposed an open records custodian, which would have the power to oversee all open records requests, do training for city employees and officials, and have the power to essentially discipline those who do not comply with the law. And those are certainly all steps in the right direction, according to, you know, folks that I've talked to who observe, you know, the city and the city's operations. Separately, she's also, I believe, the city council just approved the city budget, and it included a procurement officer position that would have the ability to review procurement situations, which is important given that the city is under federal investigation for a pay-to-play scheme. So all of those are steps in the right direction, according to attorneys and others that I've talked to. But I would say that the situation still is not perfect. And, you know, the AJC and Channel 2 are in mediation right now between the Attorney General's office and the city of Atlanta to try to come up with steps to improve the process.
Well, we did reach out to the city for a statement about that, and we had not heard back by the time that we went to air. Keisha Lance Bottoms was a city councilman before elected mayor in November. Kasim Reed held out for quite a while before actually endorsing her. But have you spoken with anyone who thinks that this knowledge or has any knowledge of Mayor Reed's handling of open records requests could have affected the outcome of the mayoral election in November last year?
So we ran a story a few weeks ago about this subpoena that we discussed earlier. And this is the subpoena that the city did not release and held secret for more than a year. And a number of attorneys and political observers said that if that subpoena had come out in February of 2017, when the others did, that it could have had some kind of impact on the mayor's race. Now, what that impact might have been, that's really difficult to say in hindsight. But what we at the, you know, I think those who follow the city and politics and those who are watching the city for its observance to open records laws are hoping is that the pressure put upon the city by the Attorney General's office, by this GBI investigation, will nudge it in the right direction.
And perhaps the Golden Padlock Award as well. We have to close, Rob, but quickly, any ideas for next year's award?
Moments after we announce every winner, I get flooded by journalists coming forward saying, you think that was bad? I got one way worse. So there's an endless pipeline of nominations.
Rob Cribb, he's an investigative reporter for the Toronto Star. He's also chair of the committee that awarded the City of Atlanta the Golden Padlock Award for its lack of transparency. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And Scott Truby, reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks so much for your ongoing work.
Thank you.
And that is it for our show today, but we always want to hear from you. Yesterday, we celebrated Juneteenth, commemorating the freeing of the last slaves on American soil. We received a few tweets from our listeners. Nathan Weaver tweeted, "I have never heard of the holiday until an episode of Black-ish last year. What a cool and important piece of American history." Gina Pardenby tweeted, "Excellent conversation on OST Talk this morning with Nicole Moore. She is an amazing educator." Thank you both for the tweets. We couldn't agree more. And you can listen to that conversation on gpbnews.org. As always, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at OST Talk, or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott. Have a great day. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting.